You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll talk about the best books to dive into this summer with the co-founder of Goodreads. Now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Lots of people love their Harleys. Frank Latta loved his motorcycle so much that he took it with him to war aboard an American submarine during the Second World War. Writer Meg Jones tells us the story of the Harley that may still be at the bottom of the ocean.
Submarines are cramped, especially World War II subs. Not a lot of space for anything not absolutely necessary to operate the ship and keep the men inside alive. They're basically torpedoes where sailors skip showers, grew beards, and shared bunks with whoever worked the opposite watch. But what if I told you that at least one American submarine carried a Harley-Davidson motorcycle on board during the war? The submarine was the USS Legato, and it was built in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, where the shipworks in that city on Lake Michigan built 28 subs during World War II. Of the millions of Americans who enlisted in the military after Pearl Harbor, I like to think quite a few were gearheads who reluctantly left their motorcycles at home as they shipped out to boot camp. Not Frank Latta. He actually figured out a way to bring his wheels with him. Latta was the captain of the USS Legato. He moved his wife and two young sons to Manitowoc in 1944 as shipyard workers finished building the submarine. At the ship's launching ceremony, the submarine slid sideways into the water, throwing up a huge wave that drenched many of the onlookers. No one living today knows exactly when or where Latta bought his Harley, but the only photo of the submarine captain astride his beloved hog shows what is believed to be a 1942 EL or FL model. The picture was likely taken in Hawaii. By the time Latta was assigned to the Legato, he was a veteran of 9 war patrols and had earned a Navy Cross, the second highest medal for valor. Before shipping out on the Legato, Latta and his machinist mate disassembled the Harley, lowered the pieces into the narrow opening, and stashed them wherever they could find room inside the submarine. When the Legato reached port and Latta had some free time, he assembled the pieces and roared off to see the sights. The Legato sunk a Japanese submarine and a cargo vessel on its first war patrol in February 1945. The last anyone heard of the Legato was in early May off the coast of Thailand. It didn't make radio contact. It didn't return to port. Within a few weeks, telegrams began to arrive at the homes of the 86 men on board, including Latta. The men were listed as missing in action. A year later, they were officially declared dead. Their families could bury no bodies, and they wouldn't know what happened until 6 decades later, when scuba divers found the shipwreck in 150 feet of water. The Legato was upright, and one of its outer torpedo doors was open. The rudder was turned hard to port, and its dive plane set for a fast dive. That probably meant Latta had fired torpedoes at an enemy ship and then tried to flee a depth charge attack. But the Legato didn't survive. In 2005, scuba divers reported seeing what looked like a huge hole punched in the side of the submarine. No hatches were open. That means the 86 men are most likely entombed in the USS Legato. Frank Latta's Harley is probably inside as well.
Meg Jones is a journalist and the author of World War II Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and find us on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
And we're joined now by the author we just heard from, Meg Jones. Her book, World War II Milwaukee, explores the stories of Milwaukee during that time period through interviews and archival research. Meg, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So how would you describe the general feeling and atmosphere in Milwaukee during World War II?
Well, it was very much a city that was hard at work. So Milwaukee, at the time of the Pearl Harbor attack, was known as the machine shop of the world. So there were lots of industry businesses, a very highly trained workforce that very quickly switched from a civilian to a military business standpoint. So at the time, it was pretty much everybody that could work in the factories was working in the factories or was working to support the workers that were in the factories. and to support those Milwaukeeans who had enlisted and were drafted into the war.
I grew up in Chicago, and I heard a lot of stories from older generations in my family about how, you know, my aunt was a block captain for the blackout tests to close off all the windows and make sure there was no light showing and people building and producing gardens and things like that. Was there that similar kind of sense of we're all in this together?
Oh, exactly. It was very much, you know, it was kind of like the last time that all of America kind of pulled together for one effort, because you really didn't have it with Korea or Vietnam or the Iraq and the Afghanistan wars. It was really the last time that pretty much everybody knew somebody that was in the military or had a close family member or a neighbor, and you could go down pretty much any neighborhood of any street in Milwaukee and see the flags with the blue stars in the windows, which signified that a family member was serving overseas in the military, or sadly you could also see the gold star banners, which meant that a loved one had been killed in action.
So let's dig deeper into some of the stories you talk about in your book. Can you tell us about Milwaukee Mayor Carl Zeidler?
Yeah, so what's interesting about Carl Zeidler is at the time Milwaukee was one of the largest cities in the U.S., and being the mayor of one of those large cities in wartime was a very important job. But Carl, who was in his early 30s at the time, decided to, he did not want to stay home. He decided to join and enlist in the Naval Reserve. And Carl was assigned to a merchant marine ship, and it was Carl's very poor luck to be in the Merchant Marine in 1942, and that was a time when the German U-boats, the Wolfpack, basically ruled the seas. So there was a lot of, there's hundreds of millions of tons of Allied shipping that was sunk by the German U-boats, and sadly, Carl's was one of those ships. He had been kind of had a meteoric rise here in Milwaukee. He had never been elected to public office before he decided to run for mayor and take on a very popular mayor, Daniel Hone, and he won and was very charismatic, blonde, blue-eyed, very handsome, had a great baritone, would sing at pretty much every function. All the women would swoon over him. In fact, when I was doing research on the chapter about Carl, I met some women who remembered him, and they were swooning still, even all these decades later. So Carl was assigned to a ship, a merchant marine ship, that left Cuba in the fall of 1942 on its way to Pakistan with munitions and airplane parts, and it never arrived. So he was one of the many, many people that was declared missing in action, and nobody ever knew what happened to him until many, many years later. But his younger brother, Frank, who became the longtime mayor of Milwaukee in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, he always wanted to know what had happened to his beloved older brother, and it was through Frank's efforts to track down and he basically was able to track down the location of like the coordinates of his brother's ship's last sighting, and then from there, then he was able to determine which U-boat it was, and he was there, he was able to track down the German U-boat captain's log, and in very heart-wrenching detail, he learned the last moments of Frank Zeidler.
So I was surprised to learn that there was actually a thriving Nazi movement in Milwaukee. Why Milwaukee?
Yeah, so I was surprised about that as well, too. I mean, I grew up here in Milwaukee, and I consider myself a native, and I had no idea. But and there were a lot of German American societies that were in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin at the time, which isn't a surprise because a very large percentage of Wisconsinites and Milwaukeeans in particular were either German immigrants or they were first or second generation of German immigrants. So there were a lot of societies that were very benign, music societies, that sort of thing. But there was also something called the Volksbund. And the Volksbund was a very pro-Nazi movement, and in the 1930s, there was a very thriving chapter of a Volksbund chapter right here in Milwaukee, and they would meet at the Milwaukee Auditorium and other places and have rallies and would dress up in the brown shirt uniforms and fly the Nazi swastika flags. And I was reading some newspapers from the time, and quite often those rallies would end in violence because local communists or protesters would protest the movement. But interestingly enough, the leader of the Milwaukee Volksbund was a man by the name of George Frobos. And toward the start of the war, a lot of the Volksbund chapter presidents and leaders across the U.S. were either indicted or were called to testify or were deported. And eventually George, the Milwaukee head of the Volksbund, became the national leader of the Volksbund. And just a year before, so this is in 1941, and just a year before, there was a huge rally in Madison Square Garden that drew like 25,000 people, all Volksbund supporters. Now, this is at a time when the Nazis, the Germans, are already engaged in World War One, and they and so George was became the leader. And about 6 months later, he was subpoenaed to testify in a grand jury out in New York.
I'm sorry, Meg, but we're going to have to leave it there. Really interesting stuff. Meg Jones is a reporter for the Wisconsin Journal Sentinel and the author of World War II Milwaukee. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.